Welcome to The Uplifters, where every week we talk to a woman who is doing big, brave things in the world. And despite having the same fears and worries that we all have, she manages to create change in her world. Today, I am deeply honored to welcome someone who fundamentally changed how I think about heroism, about belonging, and what it means to be an American. I might have burst into tears upon seeing her because her work has moved me so much. Cristina Jimenez is an Ecuadorian American activist and community organizer. She's best known as the co-founder and former executive director of United We Dream, the largest immigrant youth-led organization in the United States, and a key strategist behind DACA. She's been recognized for her work in immigrant rights and social justice as a MacArthur Fellow. And her new book, Dreaming of Home, which is published, of course, just as we're facing another massive wave of anti-immigrant rhetoric and policy fights. Cristina bravely and beautifully gives us a remarkable memoir, an impactful lesson in our own history of systemic exclusion of Black and brown immigrants specifically, and a roadmap to show us how to face our fears, whatever they may be, how to find our voices, no matter how much the systems may try to silence them, and the power of uniting as a community, and how that can literally change the world for millions of others. She is brave, she is badass, and I am really freaking excited to introduce her to you. Cristina, I'm crying again. Thank you for being here today.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me here and engaging in this conversation. I'm so grateful to connect with you, with your listeners, and the community that you have been building here, lifting up brave voices. So yeah, what a blessing to be here. Thank you.
We rise so much higher together, and your story paints that more vividly than just about any other I've ever heard. You really help us in your work understand what it means to live as an undocumented American in this country. The constant fear that you experienced, the systemic limits that were put on you, and the way that it was shaping literally every tiny thought and decision you made about where to travel, how to approach your education, where to work. But because most of us live in echo chambers, and I'll be honest, I grew up in Texas in the 1980s. I felt like I should have known and had a much deeper understanding of what you were describing than I did. But we live in echo chambers and we're only paying attention to what's impacting us directly as humans. And so I know you've dedicated hundreds of pages to accomplishing this, but I wonder if, just to start out, you could help everyone listening who hasn't had a chance to read the book understand what it's like to live as an undocumented American.
You know, it was truly a dream to be able to be at a place where our voices, people like me, get to tell our stories and be part of history and the conversation, and to explore the contradictions and also the commonalities that many of us, as you know, whether you're an immigrant or not, that we share. And I will say that was like one of the very empowering and healing things about this process of writing, because I had to go back in memory lane, growing up in Ecuador in a family that I know we didn't have much financially, but that had much love and courage. And my parents like had just so much devotion and care and love for us, their kids. But then at 13, experiencing what it's like to lose everything that you know at home. The situation in Ecuador becomes unattainable. Like, there's crisis of jobs, political crisis. My parents lose their jobs. So we end up fleeing poverty in 1998 and arriving in Queens. and sharing an apartment with a total of like 9 different people in a 1-bedroom apartment in Elmhurst, Queens, you know, very immigrant neighborhood. And growing up, I really struggled with the sense of homelessness, meaning like feeling like I didn't belong. This was a new place, a new language, a new country. And also everything around me made me feel ashamed of being an immigrant, ashamed of not having immigration papers, of my accent, of, you know, not fully knowing the language. And living with that shame, and then you layer that, the fear that you and your family could be abducted and separated by immigration agents every day. Like the smallest thing, like going to the bank or walking to school or looking for work.
Or having to stand next to somebody who's smoking marijuana.
Yes. Yes.
And totally out of your control.
And I talk about how I was so afraid in school of hanging out with different folks because I knew that any interaction with school police or with NYPD, with law enforcement, could lead to my deportation or the deportation of my family. And so just even being around folks that, you know, were smoking pot for fun in high school, and or even cutting class for, you know, like many high schoolers used to do in my time. All of those were things that I had to always be hyper vigilant about. But I will say that this fear of deportation that I live with every day really became intense and overwhelming post the terrorist attack of 9/11. Because when that happens, and at that time, I'm a senior in high school, I literally see more ICE presence in my neighborhood. I hear of neighbors, Muslim and immigrant, that are disappearing. You see in the news raids that are happening in the workplace, and you start thinking, I'll be next. My family could be next. And it is in, you know, which I think that I feel like there's so many parallels to that moment right now, in the sense that, you know, certainly the level of terror, it's 100 times worse than what it was in the early 2000s post September 11. But what was true is that the presence and the deportations and the mass raids were every day happening in communities across the country. And it is then where me and, you know, hundreds of young people and undocumented communities start getting engaged to fight these deportations. And in that fear that I could be the next person. And I remember Marie Gonzalez being one of the first young people I met, not in person, but on the news, fighting the deportation of her and her family. I thought I could be the next Marie. My family could be her parents. And I joined the campaign to stop Marie's deportation. And in a bittersweet experience, she gets to stay. Her parents end up being deported. The family is, you know, destroyed, separated. And in that bittersweet moment, though, I realized, wow, I live in fear. I live in shame. I have believed these lies that I have no right to ask for anything in this country. And yet, I was just part of an effort that stopped a deportation of a young person like me. And that taste of the kind of power of community protection that we could accomplish when we act together, even in some of the greatest and most difficult moments, was what transformed my life, my voice, and my sense of self, and how I found my voice and power eventually. And so I think what we are seeing in this moment reminds me of many of the aspects that we experienced in those early years. And the upside is that those scary and terrifying conditions gave birth to a movement. And I think we have the opportunity to do the same today.
Yeah. How are you feeling today? Because you wrote this book in a very different climate.
You know, what I've been saying across the country is, you know, just different book conversations and engagements with communities from all backgrounds. So first of all, you know, I had not even think that this book will be out in this moment, in a moment where we have the administration that we have and where the country and our government is dismantling democracy as we know it. And what I will say is that actually the first Trump administration was one of the motivators to get me to write this book. Because if there was one thing that got me through those very difficult years, where we also saw mass separation of families, deportations, so much pain in our communities, it was community and it was collective power that got us through it. And I experienced like Americans from all walks of life saying, what can we do to stop these deportations? And I thought like, we need to tell this story, that this is not just about immigrants, but this is about all of us really reconnecting with our connection as human beings and the power of solidarity and the power of us acting together to say no to injustice. And so I named this because, again, I feel like we're in both like a new moment, but similar. And I think that the answer to this moment is, one, we have to be sober about what we're facing. We are facing undemocratic conditions in this country. And that should worry all of us, not just immigrants. All of our rights, the right to speak, to use our constitutional rights to share our perspectives, to take action, to get engaged, to just be, are being threatened and are at stake. And so I think that in this moment, what I feel like may feel like the most unsurmountable challenge or moment, it is also our greatest opportunity to organize and to build communities of solidarity and to build communities of love with people that dream of making this country a home and a place where we all belong, regardless of background, regardless of race, regardless of faith, of gender, of class. And so I do think that that's the opportunity. That's where my hope is at. And I'm seeing it. I'm seeing it happen across the country. But I do think it's important to not kid ourselves about the dangers and the threats that we are facing. This administration may be using immigrants as a way to test how far they can go, how fast they can destroy democratic institutions and overreach and ignore the courts and silence dissenters. But that Americans, actually the majority of us, want to fight for a democracy that works for all of us.
Yes. And I think to your earlier point, the entire system is designed on making us feel like we can't use our individual and collective power to resist. Mm-hmm. That we can't use our voices. And so, you know, as I read your book, I kept thinking about the fact that so much of what I don't do in life, so much of what my clients and my guests and my friends don't do in life is because we're worried about what other people will think of us. We're worried about opinions. We're worried about making mistakes. Whereas you were worried about getting abducted. You were worried about spending years in inhumane treatment in detention centers, right? Like the scale of these issues are very different. And at the end of the day, we all have to figure out like how to use our voices regardless of what our fears are. And I mean, I don't want to be alarmist, but be honest, we all are at risk of ending up in detention centers right now. And I think facing those fears and finding your way through community, no matter what we're trying to do, if it's to write a book or change the freaking world, is a lesson we can take from your journey. And so I imagine you still continue to face those voices in your head that say, stay quiet, stay small. How do you balance risk and reward?
As I've been touring the country, talking about dreaming of home and bringing communities together to share our stories, I get often the question, you know, and both like young and older folks have asked me this question, like, how do you shed the fear? How do you deal with the fear? And, you know, now I am a naturalized citizen. And in many ways, people will think like, whoa, what does she have to fear? And yet, even before this administration announced that they are creating an effort and a commission to denaturalize and to take away citizenship of the 23 million Americans that have gone through naturalization processes like me, I was afraid, and I'm still afraid. Fear, in many ways, for me, you know, has not fully gone away. And because, as we've seen, like, regardless of your immigration status, and this has never been about legality, which is what I tried to show in my book, it's about who we define as American, who we want to be included in that we as Americans. And it is so racialized. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people, even Native Americans, people with that have been born here, they're being stopped. They are being put in jails and in detention facilities with inhumane conditions. So it's never been about, you know, that legality. So to this point about, like, you know, all of us should be fearful, I think, unfortunately, let's be sober. I think that's true. And also, fear does not have to stop us and define who we are and what we are capable of doing. So for me, it's not, you know, the question is not like, oh, how do we get rid of fear? Let me give you, you know, the top three things to get rid of your fear. You know, I'm not here like sharing a self-help book around like how do we get rid of our fears, because really it is about moving through the fear. And moving through the fear is where you find courage and where you keep sort of building that muscle of finding your voice, your strength, your role. And that doesn't happen alone. It happens in community. So, you know, the reason why I really focus on my journey in Dreaming of Home is that, like, you know, imagine this young girl who was undocumented and ashamed of being brown and immigrant and having an accent and living in fear of deportation. And she's silent. She has no voice. And then you see this transformation that happens when I meet other young people fighting for their rights and against tuition hikes in New York City, immigrant and non-immigrant alike. And I start thinking, wow, people think that they could do that? Wow. And then I meet people that are fighting deportations. And then I join those efforts to stop, you know, fighting deportations. And then I have the taste of what collective power can do when I start stopping those deportations. And so that transformation of going from shame and fear to finding my voice, finding my power, and then becoming a leader and building a social justice movement is what we're all capable of. And it doesn't mean that you have to end up being an organizer and, you know, a leader and a movement. You could choose how to engage, but we are not defined by the fear. And so what I wanted to do is offer Dreaming of Home as a guide for how we can go ourselves through a process of transformation, of finding our own power and tapping into that and finding power in community to create change and to address the injustices that we may see in our communities and in the world. And, you know, that starts with you and then it connects to community. So that roadmap, that experience, that journey, it's what I hope that people can tap into and find their own path around, especially in this moment where I feel there's so much energy and curiosity about what people can do.
Yeah. Well, and I think so much of our collective inaction right now comes from a deep sense of overwhelm and hopelessness. And in your book, we see again and again how surrounding yourself with courageous people who were scared but acting anyway helped you see that potential within yourself. How are you managing right now that the feelings of, I think, sort of collective hopelessness, I don't know any other word for it, this feeling of it's the problem's too big. We keep getting these little signals that, like, things are getting better. Crap, it all went off a cliff.
Yeah, no, I hear that. And I will say that I resonate with that so much. Like, that's my everyday experience. Like, days when I feel like I'm so hopeful and I'm inspired by Americans from all walks of life taking action and defending their immigrant neighbors and donating to funds and stopping people's deportations and sharing stories. And, you know, and then there are days where, like, even when that's happening, I feel, yeah, I feel worried and overwhelmed and just uncertain about the future. So, you know, I definitely want to be very real that it's part of our lives right now. Like, if we're not going through those like highs and lows, like, we're just not human. Mm-hmm. And again, that was, again, part of my goal and my intention in the book, that I'm just telling the story of how we as immigrants are just like everybody else. We have dreams, we have fears, we have high moments and low moments. And we fall in love and, you know, we have dreams and we're working hard to care for our loved ones. And in this case, like, I am like everyone else. Like, I think sometimes, you know, when people may read the book or have heard about my work and the story, like, you might think, like, this person, you know, Christina must be feeling hopeful and powerful every day. And that's just not the truth. Like, you know, our authentic lives right now is that we are going through those highs and lows. So I will say that every day is a practice around this for me. But what I will say is that when I start to feel like just very overwhelmed and I can't see the answers and I'm feeling like I'm not doing enough and what I'm doing may not get us to even make an inch of change, the thing that helps me change that and shift that is connecting back to my community. My community of friends and organizers, going to a community meeting, going to a training for how people are supporting each other to protect their immigrant neighbors, or talking to folks about the work that they're doing in different states to organize their communities, or to educators that are getting ready for back to school. And it is in those conversations that I'm like, oh my God, it's like, we're the majority. Look at all of us doing all of this work. But I will say, my call, and then when I get very, like, you know, I think this conversation not only gave me hopeful, but they gave me bumped up and then like very serious about like, okay, we are on the business of building power, building change, and we got to be disciplined about it. Mm-hmm. And so the call that I'm making to folks is that don't let the people in power right now convince us that we are powerless. Mm-hmm. That's what they actually mm-hmm. want. Mm-hmm. So if we believe that we are letting them win, it is up to us to fight for the America that is possible. It is up to all of us. It's not just the immigrants that are in the front lines right now, suffering the impact of cruel, inhumane, racist policies, or trans communities that are also in the front lines of many of these attacks. It is up to all of us mm-hmm. to make sure that we create the change that we want to see in this country. So that's the assignment, you know. So then the question is, how do we do it? What do we do? And I think the thing that I am conscious about is that, you know, I was really afraid of even like the book being out in this moment, of what it will mean for my own safety, the safety of my family, and the safety of people coming to a book event. So I just want to be real about that. But what helped me make a decision to be out here sharing the story, bringing people together, sharing Dreaming of Home as a roadmap for how we can create change, is also because I'm taking responsibility of the added layer of protection that I have now as a naturalized citizen. Mm-hmm. And I think about, for the people who are undocumented and they are living in such a moment where they cannot even go out of their homes to buy groceries, how am I showing up with the added protection privilege that I have for them and for this country? Mm-hmm. So that's the question. How does that look like for you if, you know, you're born here? How does that look like for you if you come from affluent communities, et cetera, et cetera? And I think all of us have a role.
Yeah, I think it's hard to know what that role is and where we can get involved and where we can use our privilege. And I mean, I did like ridiculous things like reaching out to people in my life who might have teams that are undocumented and just saying, I'm here if there's anything I can do. And it felt like the most absurd thing to say, but I felt like not saying it was worse.
It's so important. And I am so glad that you're sharing that, because that may sound so simple, but I have to tell you this. Immigrants and people close to immigrants are feeling so unwanted and rejected and dehumanized in this moment, that just reminding them that another human sees them as human and will be there in some capacity to show up, to support.
Who even knows what that could be, but...
And there's so many ways. You know, like, I've seen people, again, like, donating, going to their churches or places of faith and supporting communities there, sharing Dreaming of Home with your neighbors and with your network so that people start understanding, like, what is this all about? Why are we even here? And or joining, you know, local community organizations in your neighborhood, in your state, or even just sharing with immigrants around your life that you care about them, that you're thinking about them, that if they need something, they can holler at you. It is just goes such a long way. And so, you know, I'm naming, like, there's like the small and super significant and impactful gestures and actions of solidarity and love and care. And then there's also those that, like, you know, are more perhaps like risky and courageous when people are coming together to create teams to defend their neighbors and communities in their neighborhood. And they're on their phones and they have WhatsApp channels and sharing information, and people alert themselves when, like, they see eyes and they start alerting their neighbors. And that all of that matters. So, you know, there's no one way. You shouldn't make whatever you think about perfection being the enemy of the good. Actually, all of it helps in a moment where the goal is to dehumanize immigrant communities and lock them up and deport them to other places in the world.
I'm thinking about what we learned from your journey here, which is, I'm picturing you in my mind, this little teenage girl in her giant school with all these strangers and a strange rules and strange lockers and strange language, and the desire to sort of hide, to stay safe, was very realistic and makes a lot of sense. And you found your way out from the shadows and your voice grew by just sort of stepping in and engaging. And so I think what I'm taking from your story and from your advice right now is tiptoe in if you must. You don't have to start with a helmet and a protected vest, but step in and then see where that takes you. I mean, you may not know where that journey is going. It may just be cans of soup, right? But it also may be helping to write policy and showing up at protest.
Yeah. You know, and the biggest thing I will say is that alone and in isolation, we will lose. In silence, we will lose. In community, we can win.
An invisibility. You know, I think a lot about that in your story, because of course the natural tension is that you have to hide in order to stay safe. And then you hear these stories of, well, I was anti-immigrant, and then Carla from the diner in my small town in Wyoming was taken away by ICE, and suddenly I understood.
In silence and in hiding, it's much more easy to be deported, kidnapped without anyone knowing. And what I learned very quickly as I was sharing, when I, like, joined these efforts to stop deportations, I was like, oh, wait a minute. I'm learning that in hiding and living in the shadows, I am less safe. And coming out as undocumented, taking space, taking action, becoming more visible, being part of a community, actually, it's where I'm safe. It's what makes them more safe. And I do think that that stays true today. But I will say that for undocumented people who, like, right now, like, don't want to share their stories, don't want to, like, you know, put themselves out there, it's like, rightly so. Even then, you're seeing people who are at risk, who are still courageously out there. But again, I think that this is where like all of us can engage in different ways. But in isolation and in hiding, we have less protection.
For all of us.
For all of us.
Yeah. And I think that is such an important point here is that, number one, we're all immigrants, except for the Indigenous Americans. It's like ex-smokers. They always say, and nobody is more self-righteous than an ex-smoker. About I kind of think immigration is the same thing. That like, okay, yeah, my family, they were immigrants in the 1700s, but they were still immigrants. Mm-hmm. They were still escaping really challenging situations to come to this place of hope and promise. And it's true for all of us. We are all new Americans, really, because America is new.
Oh, the project of these aspirational values of, you know, freedom and justice and opportunity for all, it's still a project that we're working on.
Yeah.
Like it has not realized. And it's so important to like anchor ourselves in those aspirational values. I mean, in fact, is what inspire many people to seek refuge and to seek a new life here. And at the same time, and this is, you know, why in Dreaming of Home, I also help the reader and invite the reader to connect some of the historical dots here. But it's so important to anchor ourselves on those values that in many ways drive migration, and also then connect it to the reality of this country and its history, its legacy of slavery and systematic racism, its legacy of colonialism and genocide of Native American communities, and using immigration and designing the immigration system in a way that was rooted in a true like belief of eugenics and a hierarchy of race. And so we, you know, before 1920, the country had technically an open border policy. Mostly people from Europe were coming to the country, and all they had to do was like sign up, register, and they could live here, reunite with their family members. Our government used to help them reunite with their family members, right? But then in the 1920s, the first act that creates our immigration system is designed around the belief that Northern European countries were the countries where like the best white race came from, and that those were the immigrants that we wanted, and everybody else was not a desirable immigrant. So then the system was designed around these quotas. So, you know, a lot of us don't know that. I certainly did not learn that.
I didn't know it. No. American history doesn't teach that, imagine.
Yeah. And, you know, the eugenics scientists, right? Like, we're like using all of these scientific, quote unquote, data.
And writing the SAT questions. That was another big shock for me in reading it. I was like, what?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, so pervasive, right? Like the systematic racism, the anti-blackness, the colonial history, and how our systems and policies have been shaped around that. It's important for us to connect the dots, because then that helps us understand like, oh, wait a minute, why is it that in today's world, this administration, you know, promotes a program for refugees who are white from South Africa, mm-hmm. and at the same time, denies refugee and asylum for Black and brown people, you know, seeking refuge.
Who've grown up here.
Yeah. And is trying to basically take away the immigration status of many people that are here already legally. So, you know, I think that if we like become more just aware of how the history and our legacy as a country has shaped many of the policies, I think that we start understanding why we're here, but also what would it take to get us to building a multiracial democracy that stays true to its aspirational values.
I've heard in hundreds of stories on this podcast and throughout history how from the bleakest times, we build the brightest.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hold on to that as hope that we can build a home together that is more inclusive and accepting and frankly, better, just better. Because how many brilliant leaders have we missed out on because we've pushed them out of the country?
Mm-hmm.
Are we, because we've told them they aren't welcome here or they can't be themselves here?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I You know, as I was sharing earlier, I do think the parallels here is that I know that when there was a mass uptake of deportations, the building of the Department of Homeland Security, mm-hmm. the funding that went into creating ICE and gave more resources to Border Patrol and other law enforcement. And now there's like have been billions of dollars that just, you know, in the last weeks have been allocated to that law enforcement agency that has become as big as, you know, the size of the military of some countries around the world. Even in the midst of that, there was a movement that was born of young, courageous, undocumented people. Like, imagine that. Undocumented people who were risking their lives and who were risking deportation built a movement. I would also say not alone. Mm-hmm. There were always the allies. There were always the teachers, the educators, the faith leaders, the civil rights elders that coach and train so many of us. You know, and I think of many who were part of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that became my mentors over time. So we were never doing this alone. But if this small group of young, courageous people could build a movement in those conditions, like imagine what all of us can do in this moment. And so I truly believe that this is the moment where the new movement, when a new movement is going to rise.
I believe it too. Thank you for giving us hope. Thank you for helping us see beyond our own experiences and giving us a roadmap for how we can lean into creating change instead of hiding and hoping that it will change on it.
Thank you. So good to be here.
So good to have you. Listeners, I will share links to Christina's work, read her book, share her book, read it again. I listened to it on Audible. It's amazing. She narrates it. And I got to like garden with Christina and go to the store with Christina. And we just got to have like our lives together because she was just coaching me and talking to me the entire time. So highly recommend the Audible version. And then I'll share all the action steps and bullets that you outlined, Christina. Thank you again for everything you're doing in the world.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Uplifters podcast. If you're getting a boost from these episodes, please share them with the Uplifters in your life and then join us in conversation over at theuplifterspodcast.com. Head over to Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast and like, follow, and rate our show. It'll really help us connect with more Uplifters. And it'll ensure you never miss one of these beautiful stories. Mwah! Big love.
Painted water sunshine with rosemary and thyme. Dwell in the perplexing, though you find it vexing. Toss a star and hover, be your own best lover. Relish in a new prime, plant a tree in springtime. Dance with idle hindsight, bring the sun to twilight. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up. Lift you up, whoa. Whoa, lift you up. Whoa, lift you up. Do, 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 do.
Beautiful.
I cried. It's that little thing you did with your voice.
Right, in the pre-chorus, right?
Uh-huh. I was like...
Mommy, stop crying. Mommy, stop crying. You're disturbing the peace.